طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح طفلة تمتطي.
Welcome to the July 17th edition of This Week in Palestine on WZBC 90.3 FM, a weekly show hosted for many years by our beloved Sharif Fam and continued in his loving memory by his friends. I'm your host, Vespina Moutsouris, and on today's show, we continue our conversation on the power of grassroots nonviolent resistance to stand up against violence, oppression, and injustice. We'll be speaking shortly with Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence based in Chicago. Kathy is a longtime peace activist and co-coordinator of this campaign to end U.S. and military economic warfare. As a co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness, she helped form 70 delegations from 1996 to 2003 that openly defied sanctions by bringing medicines to children and families in Iraq. Kathy and her companions lived in Baghdad throughout the Shock and Awe bombing campaign. In 2010, she made three trips to Afghanistan, helping to connect U.S. peace activists with Afghan youth peace volunteers and other representatives of civil society. In the spring of 2011, she joined a delegation to Afghanistan again to join Afghan youth peace volunteers in their campaign, Live Without Wars. She's also visited Pakistan twice since 2009 and was part of a small delegation that reported from Gaza during Israel's brutal Operation Cast Lead assault. Kathy was sentenced in the past to 1 year in federal prison for planting corn on nuclear missile silo sites between 1988 and 1989. She spent 3 months in Peking prison in 2004 for crossing the line at Fort Benning's military training school. As a tax refuser, Kathy has not paid federal income taxes since 1980. She and her companions in Chicago believe nonviolence necessarily involves simplicity, service, sharing of resources, and nonviolent direct action in resistance to war and oppression. If you'd like to find out more about the work of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, you can visit their website at www.vcnv.org. But first, our weekly update of news from Palestine by the International Middle East Media Center. Stay tuned for our upcoming interview with Kathy Kelly.
The details with IMEMC's Kevin Murphy.
There was one injured, another arrested, while scores were treated for effects of tear gas inhalation as Israeli troops attacked on Friday nonviolent protests organized in a number of West Bank communities. Protests were reported in the villages of Al-Nabi Saleh, Bilayin and Nilayin in the central West Bank, as well as Al-Masra in the south. One man was injured, scores treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation when soldiers attacked the weekly anti-wall protest at the village of Bilayin on Friday. International and Israeli supporters joined villagers and tried to reach local farmers' lands the army gave back after rerouting the wall there. Troops fired tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets at protesters, injuring the head of the local village committee, Ayed Bernat. Many other protesters were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. Also on Friday, Israeli troops attacked the weekly anti-wall protest in the village of Nilayin, where the residents and their Israeli and international supporters held their Friday midday prayers near the Israeli wall. Protesters then marched up to the wall. Troops fired tear gas at protesters, causing many to suffer from tear gas inhalation. In the nearby Al-Nabi Saleh, villagers and their Israeli and international supporters marched to local farmers' lands Israel took to build a new settlement. Troops attacked protesters with tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. Soldiers then arrested Ayed Tamimi, a local organizer, after beating him up. Other residents suffered effects of tear gas inhalation. International Israeli supporters also joined villagers at Al-Masra village near Bethlehem, southern West Bank. Troops attacked villagers before they left the village and did not allow them to reach their lands where Israel is building the wall. Soldiers fired tear gas at protesters and forced them back into the village. Local sources reported cases of tear gas inhalation among protesters. For IMEMC.org, this is Kevin Murphy.
A meeting of Arab states' foreign ministers backed this week the Palestinian Authority's move to win recognition of a Palestinian state by the UN in September 2011. The decision comes amidst Israeli refusal to go back to the negotiation table with the Palestinians based on Palestinian conditions. IMEMC's Rami Al-Mighari has more.
The Arab states' decision suggests that the PA has the right to ask for the UN recognition after all international efforts have so far failed to urge Israel to stop illegal settlement activities on occupied Palestinian lands, including East Jerusalem. The PA, from its part, said it is determined to reach the UN by September to get that recognition. PA officials, including President Mahmoud Abbas, have hinted at the possibility they would refrain from going to the UN if Israel halts all settlement construction on Palestinian lands. Israeli leaders, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, reiterated their refusal to stop the activities and said they are willing to return back to the negotiations table unconditionally. Israeli opposition leader Tzipi Livni stated this week that policies of Netanyahu are counterproductive. Meanwhile, more than 30 German diplomats and former ambassadors were reported to have submitted a letter to Germany's Chancellor Angela Merkel, advising her to back a declaration of a Palestinian state on borders of 1967. The letter also reads that continued Israeli settlement activities would undermine chances of peace in the region. In other news, Israeli military discussed this week possible military escalation against the Gaza Strip, holding the ruling Hamas party responsible for the latest breakout of violence on Gaza-Israel border lines. On a different note, Farhat called on the Fatah party in the West Bank to go ahead with implementing a recent conciliation agreement with his party in Cairo. Both parties have yet failed to execute the agreement due to difference on the name of a premier for the upcoming unity government. Fatah's leader and PA president Mahmoud Abbas insists that his current PM Salam Fayyad should assume the post. Rami Al-Mighari, IMEMC.org, Gaza.
Israel denies hundreds of visitors entry to the country as they declared their intention to visit the occupied Palestinian territories. And the Israeli Air Force shells the Gaza Strip wounding civilians. The details and more with IMEMC's David Steele.
On Friday, Israeli soldiers abducted three Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including the daughter of a female legislator from the central West Bank city of Ramallah. Three more Palestinians were abducted in occupied East Jerusalem on Thursday at night. Hundreds of participants of Welcome to Palestine were blocked from boarding flights to Tel Aviv's Ben-Gurion Airport at the request of the Israeli security forces. 120 participants who made it through to Ben-Gurion were detained and later deported. Under 50 people were able to make it through to the West Bank to take part in the week of activities. On Saturday at night, the Israeli Air Force carried out an airstrike targeting a brick factory east of Gaza City. Extensive damage, including to local homes, was reported, but there were no injuries. In a separate incident, Palestinian medical sources reported that on Saturday at night, Israeli soldiers, based near the northern Gazan border, opened automatic fire at a number of Palestinian homes, wounding a young Palestinian woman and inflicting damage to property. On Sunday evening, Israeli troops invaded the Al-Asawiyah town, occupied East Jerusalem, and clashed with local youths who hurled stones and empty bottles at them. The army also used its undercover forces in attacking the residents. Soldiers fired gas bombs and rubber-coated metal bullets, leading to several injuries, medical sources in Jerusalem have reported. In addition, troops broke into Biddo Club, northwest of Jerusalem, and confiscated several computers after destroying furniture and property. Pre-dawn raids occurred on Tuesday in the West Bank village of Hussan near Bethlehem. Two youths, including a minor, were detained during the raid by Israeli military forces. The Israeli army allegedly destroyed wells and water pumps in three Jordan Valley villages on Tuesday. The villages of Al-Akrabaniya, Al-Nasriya and Beit Hassan all allegedly had equipment confiscated or destroyed. The villages are apparently located in Area A. The destruction of wells and associated equipment in an occupied territory is illegal under Article 53 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. The Israeli army has decided to expropriate large areas of Palestinian land in the Bethlehem district in order to expand the Efrat illegal settlement, which was originally built on lands illegally annexed from residents of Al-Khada district south of Bethlehem. Palestinian medical sources have reported that a 19-year-old college student was shot and killed on Wednesday at dawn by Israeli military fire in Al-Farah refugee camp north of the northern West Bank city of Nablus. Several residents were abducted. Eyewitnesses reported that at least 11 armoured Israeli military vehicles invaded the refugee camp at approximately 3 a.m, broke into and searched several homes, causing damages. In addition, the eyewitnesses added that as Sahan was walking towards the camp's mosque to perform dawn prayers, soldiers opened fire at him, hitting the major artery in his thigh. He was then allegedly left to die by the soldiers, who prevented local medics from attending to him. On Wednesday at dawn, the Israeli Air Force carried out 2 airstrikes targeting a blacksmith's workshop in Gaza City, leading to damage and 1 injury. The blacksmith's workshop was destroyed and several nearby homes sustained damages in the attack, whilst the main waterline in the neighbourhood was shattered. 2 hours after the initial attack, the Air Force struck the same area again, causing further damage and destruction. 11 Palestinian teenagers were arrested in the Palestinian district of Silwan in East Jerusalem. The teenagers, aged between 14 and 17, were taken from their homes by Israeli military on Wednesday during a raid of the area. Palestinian medical sources reported on the same Wednesday that a Palestinian youth was injured when a group of Israeli settlers ambushed a Palestinian car near the northern West Bank city of Jenin. They hurled stones at them from a close range while threatening to shoot them dead. The Israeli Air Force carried out on Wednesday at night an airstrike targeting the border area between Gaza and Egypt in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, as well as a shed in Gaza City. Palestinian medical sources reported that 5 residents were injured and 1 remained missing, likely buried under the rubble after the Israeli Air Force bombarded a tunnel at the Gaza-Egypt border in Rafah in the southern part of the Strip. As Israel escalates its arrest campaign against Palestinians in Jerusalem, including children, a leading member of the Al-Bustan Popular Committee has reported that Israel collected more than $900,000 in fines imposed on Palestinian children in Jerusalem over the past 9 months. The Palestinian Society for Fishing and Water Sports reported that the international boat Olivia, run by human rights activists to monitor Israeli violations against Palestinian fishermen, was located in front of the Gaza shore after losing all communications for 1 hour after the Israeli Navy attacked it. The Navy used water cannons against the boat, causing damage to its communication systems and damaging its engine. Several international activists were on board the boat when the attack took place. The Israeli Air Force has carried out a series of airstrikes targeting several areas in the Gaza Strip, leading to damages and 4 injuries amongst the civilian population. 2 of the wounded are children. Adham Abu Salmiya, spokesperson of the Higher Committee Emergency Services in Gaza, reported that the 2 children were injured when the army bombarded land where they played near a residential building in Gaza City. 2 more residents were wounded when the army bombarded an area in central Gaza and were moved to the Al-Aqsa Hospital. For IMEMC.org, this is David Steele.
And welcome back to This Week in Palestine. And thank you, Kathy, for joining us so early on a Sunday morning.
Thank you, Despina.
You're welcome. I'd like to start our conversation today by asking you what motivated you to participate recently in the Gaza Flotilla and in the Welcome to Palestine campaign, and how does these experiences relate to other journeys you've taken in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and other parts of the world?
Well, you know, any time that you leave a war zone and you've got the blue American passport, you know you're going back to safety and security. There's an unsettling feeling, and there should be. Why should I be the one that gets safety and security? And I had been in Gaza during the final days of the Operation Cast Lead assault, and it was horrible. The infrastructure was reduced to rubble in many places, and civilian homes had been hit, and hospitals, and mosques, and universities. And I remember a doctor from the burn unit, his name was Dr. Nafiz Abu Shabhab, put his head in his hands, and he said, the world watched for 22 days, and no country did anything. Well, that was true. But I think since that time, and also with the horrible shock of the Mavi Marmara and the execution on the deck of people and also helicopter gunships shooting at civilians, international civil society has reflected in the formation of the Flotilla Project that they can't just watch and sit on their hands and pretend that we're not aware of what's going on. And so I think the Flotilla, the International Flotilla Project, from its inception years ago and throughout the very persistent and hard work that's been required to form these international flotillas has shown that international civil society is prepared to try to take action. And so I very much wanted to be a part of this. Now, I'm really glad that you are asking this difficult question of how does this compare with other countries, because, I mean, really for years my focus was almost entirely on the economic sanctions against Iraq. And certainly those economic sanctions were the most comprehensive economic sanctions ever imposed in modern history. But I felt that, you know, those of us who had focused so much on the economic sanctions against Iraq ought not to ignore what was happening in Gaza. But one difference was that it was possible, it wasn't easy, but it was possible to enter into Iraq and to travel in various parts of the country. We were always kind of under the thumb of Saddam Hussein's dictatorship. But I think one of the exacerbating causes of misery in Gaza is that people cannot enter in and out. And the Rafah border crossing opening doesn't seem to make much of a difference. I just talked to a young friend from Rafah yesterday, and he said he sees almost no difference whatsoever in terms of people being able to come and go. And I've also recently been to Afghanistan four times in the past year. And I guess I should say that in Afghanistan, the poverty is so lethal that 850 children die every single day. But I think that it's understandable that young people in Afghanistan have formed such an affinity with some of the young people they've spoken with by Skype phone calls and through the internet in Gaza, because they likewise feel trapped, they feel imprisoned. And of course, the reality in any of the countries that I visited is that the media doesn't portray what it's like for the people who are bearing the brunt of these wars, both military and economic. You just don't get the sense of what it's like to be trapped and unable to protect your children and unable to construct a better life for yourselves because of the constant war making. And people aren't responsible for having done anything to affect the people of the United States, and yet we're the ones who are helping supply these arsenals for the Israeli government. We're very implicated. And most people in the United States barely even know what the consequences of our economic development are.
And that's very ironic that there's some mobility in war zones like Afghanistan and Pakistan, yet in Gaza, no one can get in. It's almost hermetically sealed by the Israeli government, of course, with complicity of our government and European governments. Having said that, can you describe some of the highlights of your recent trip during the flotilla and in your attempt to enter Israel?
Well, I was very impressed with the people, both those who had organized the flotilla and those who were helping to get our effort afloat and setting sail. I was particularly impressed by Anne Wright. She is a force to contend with in the best possible sense of the word. She brings all of her skills in terms of diplomacy and organizing and analysis and writing, and is a tremendous motivator and animator. Yeah, pulls out the best in people. So it was a real privilege to watch her. I also was impressed that Mustafa al-Barghouti came to visit us when we were on the boat. We were at this point stuck, docked in a military harbor. The Greeks had forced our ship back, and the captain was still in jail, and it was looking pretty bleak, to tell you the truth. And he came and sat with us, and this was a real privilege to hear from him and to hear his upbeat report. He's really looking forward to September as being a time that might make a real difference as the people of Palestine petition for statehood at the United Nations and the General Assembly. It was important for me to be part of the fast across from the United States Embassy. At that point, we were certainly fasting for freedom for Gazans. We were fasting to free our boat and also to free the captain of the boat, who was still in jail. And we were arrested by Greek police, I think, on orders from the United States Embassy, because we didn't want to leave this small space that we were occupying across from the embassy. But then about on July 4th, Spanish activists who also were unable to set sail because the Greek government had imposed bureaucratic procedures that prevented their boat from leaving. They went into their embassy, and they refused to leave. They were inside the embassy. They more or less occupied it. And it was so amazing because when I went over to see the Spaniards in their embassy, it almost it looked like an opera scene. You know, they're occupying the balconies of the embassy. They're looking out on the Acropolis. They've got their flags festooning and their banners hanging in the front of the embassy. And there was one Greek security guard working to kind of protect the embassy. That was it. And it was clear that they didn't need any more security. There wasn't any possible hint of a threat that this was a political action, but it wasn't a violent action. Well, over at the U.S. Embassy, there's a long line of cars from the employees who work inside the embassy, and they all have to be examined one by one to see if there's anything attached underneath that might be an explosive, and they've got Brinks guards, and they've got Greek police, and the place is fortified, and it's got spike walls, and it just looks like a huge military compound. And this is true of U.S. embassies around the world. Now, why? I think it's because the practices of the United States, and in the case of its alliance with Israel, are unsustainable, and they occasion so much antagonism that people in other parts of the world are angry at people in the United States and at our representatives in other parts of the world. So we held that fast for 3 days across from the embassy. And I should also say that at no point did anybody from the U.S. embassy until 5 days had passed go and visit this U.S. citizen, the captain of the boat who had been placed in jail because mm-hmm. the boat had left the Greek port. Now, why did the boat leave the Greek port? You know, two of those boats in the flotilla had been sabotaged, and there was every reason to expect that if you sat around and waited, eventually your turn would come along. And so a Greek independent judiciary team, when the captain finally did go before the judges, decided, they ruled that he was right in believing that he better kind of make a break for it and leave that port, and so he was freed without needing to pay any bail, and the major charges were all dropped.
And that's good to hear. And recently also has been reported that no one from the U.S. consulate has visited the Audacity of Hope in the harbor either, and the electricity has been cut off, and they're basically just three women there, you know, stranded with no support or even acknowledgement from their government. It's just, you know, simply to make a visit to say, okay, are you still alive? Are you okay? Is there something that you need? It's almost as if they're just abandoned to their fate.
Well, and with 100-degree temperatures, initially there were six women and four of them over 60 and sweltering on that boat. And we've been calling the State Department very constantly and trying to clamor for some kind of encouragement to the Greek government to restore shore power and at least let people have electricity. But it's really a shame that they were treated as though they were non-people. It's not too late to call the State Department. One of the reasons we were thinking it's a good idea to call today is because Hillary Clinton is in Greece, and so it would be a good idea to encourage Hillary Clinton to speak out, although I think that her views on the flotilla were made clear when she suggested that this was a provocative action.
Now, there were several opinions given as to what motivated the Greek government to take the actions that it took to sabotage the flotilla efforts, and there have also been viewpoints expressed about a dichotomy between the reactions of the Greek people and versus the Greek government. Myself, I am a dual national. I'm a citizen of both Greece and the U.S., so I follow that quite closely in the press over there, and I want to know what were the reactions of the Greek people to your flotilla, and what do you think actually motivated the Greek government to take the actions that it took on behalf of Israel?
Well, of course, the development that's happening within Athens in the square called Syntagma Square is a brilliant demonstration of democracy at work. And people come together and have an assembly at 9 o'clock at night, and various affinity groups are well represented. It's really quite organized, and people have been occupying that square for many weeks. And our sense is that there's huge support for ending the siege against Gaza and for international civil society to take actions, and that the Greek society in general was so supportive of the flotilla effort in the past that that's why so many of the ships were planning to leave from the ports in Greece. The Greek government has been engaging in joint military operations with the Israeli army, and to their governance, this is seen as a big plus. I think that the competition, in a sense, between Greece and Turkey over the years has been affected now because some of the attentiveness that was given to perhaps tourism that could be steered toward Greece, or cooperation with tourism that could be steered toward Turkey, has now been directed toward Greece. There's a kind of a carrot that's been held out by the Israeli government, cooperate with us and we can make life more advantageous for you. But also the Greek government is right now in terrible straits. Financially, they've had draconian measures imposed on them. I mean, worse than what the most Republican hawk in the United States might ever imagine in terms of austerity measures that might be a consequence of the United States economy failing. And it's looking so bleak in the days ahead. And so the Greek government survived a no-confidence vote, and it looks as though they're wanting to be, I think, even subservient to the demands of other governments that could harm them, that could do even more to inflict punishment on Greece if it doesn't go along with demands that are being made of it by the IMF and the World Bank. And I think by governments like that of the United States and Israel, which have now congratulated the Greek government and thanked the Greek government for going along with Israel's effort to stop the flotilla from oversailing. I mean, I should also mention, I'm from Illinois, Senator Mark Kirk, for reasons I can't quite understand, called on U.S. Special Forces to cooperate with the Israeli government in disabling the flotilla.
In addition to that, also, Israel, very similar to the actions that it's taken in the United States, has also tried to, ingratiate itself with Europe for many years, I'd say probably even for decades, to see itself as like an outpost of European civilization in the Middle East. And in addition to the reasons that you mentioned, the economic situation, closer military cooperation, in the case of Greece, also closer economic cooperation, talks about a pipeline and so forth, I think that there's also like a ideological collusion here with Zionism, because one of the things that the Israelis continually promote is how they're like a bulwark against fanatics in the Arab and the Muslim world. And unfortunately, on one level, I do believe that the Greek government and even some Greek people do collude with that particular sense. What's your response to that?
Well, that may be one of the reasons why the government of Israel was almost panicked at the thought of people trying to come to Israel with the flotilla. There were many efforts on the part of people from France and from Spain, from the United Kingdom. I participated myself coming over from Greece to enter into Israel and say very clearly, this is why I'm coming. And in the past, people have, tried to finesse entrance into the country by giving any reason other than to say, I'm going because I want to be in solidarity with people in the West Bank and Gaza. Well, if people were part of this effort to join in the Welcome to Palestine campaign, and they were known to be traveling for that purpose, they were stopped in the European capitals. They weren't even allowed to board the plane. I was able to get on a flight leaving Athens, but I was wearing a T-shirt that said, USA Boat to Gaza. I had not said one word, and I was pulled out of the line.
The T-shirt
for my
got
T-shirt.
You into trouble.
Yeah, and I was deported within 3 hours. So I think that it's a difficult reality when another country doesn't have even a tiny fraction of your military strength, and that's the case with regard to Gaza and the West Bank and Israel. People in Gaza and the West Bank have not even a tiny fraction of the weapon strength of Israel. But I would say that Israel has not even a tiny fraction of the moral grounding of people who are trapped in Gaza right now. And so, you know, the Israeli government doesn't want to have that reality exposed. And that's what projects like the flotilla, or if you will, the flytilla, but many, many other projects that have been going on are trying to expose that. You know, going back to that Operation Cast Lead, I certainly believe we must all feel remorse and regret for every family that's ever been traumatized or experienced bereavement in the villages that border Gaza, in Sidero and other places where rocket attacks have happened. But the disproportionate capacity of the Israeli government to kill and to destroy, which has been exercised, is appalling. I mean, there were at least 1,350 people killed. Over 300 of them were children in that Operation Cast Lead. And there were 11 people killed on the Israeli side, four of them Israeli soldiers killed by friendly fire. So what do you do with that kind of overwhelming capacity to kill that gets exercised again and again? It happened in 2006 in the Hezbollah-Israeli summer war of 2006. Many of us who've been in the West Bank, while villages or towns have been under siege and bombardment, have seen this happen. I was in the Jenin camp in 2002, and 103-story buildings were completely destroyed. You know, people were sifting through the rubble trying to find the remains of their loved ones. And this goes on and on and on. And so I think that there's certainly a desire on the part of the Israeli government to say that, that they're the representatives of democracy and and ethical behavior, but it's simply not borne out in their actions.
Right. Ultimately, what do you believe that Israel is afraid of? Why does it go to such extreme lengths to silence dissent and prevent any kind of truth about the reality of Gaza or Palestine or Palestinians?
Well, I think that this is a question that has to look backwards to the horrible history of the Holocaust and the persecution of Jewish people through many centuries. I think there's a sense that on the part of people who rise into governance of Israel that they have to hold the line, that they're responsible, that if they waver, then they'll leave the state vulnerable to people who feel hatred and would want to persecute Israelis. And of course, the terrible reality is that the more that Israel behaves as a menacing and a threatening and an unfair international outlaw, the more there is going to be a feeling of and justifiable antagonism that people will hold. And so I think that they're basically digging their grave, and maybe they know it, and that with that comes a terrible fear. But it doesn't have to go that way. I mean, I think that there's so many groups within Israel who have a much different vision, and it gets silenced and distanced from the mainstream, but you've got groups like the Israeli Coalition Against Housing Demolition, the Yesh Gavul, the Refuseniks, the Commandos for Peace, who refuse to serve in the Israeli Defense Forces, and when they go out and speak, will only go out and speak if they've got a Palestinian at their side. There are many, many people, I think, within Israel who could hold forth a different vision that's grounded on rationality and real courage.
What do you think are the accomplishments of the flotilla, despite the fact that you did not reach Gaza, even though there are still some ships that are attempting to go to Gaza today?
Well, and we should, of course, remember that people still have the ships. I think, you know, the U.S. boat to Gaza had anticipated that the Israelis would board the boat and confiscate the boat. So it's not the end of flotilla actions. I think that a major accomplishment was that there was more exposure of Israel's refusal to allow people to enter into Gaza or even into the West Bank, and the plight of the people in Gaza, where there's such a huge difficulty in reconstructing, because it's being treated almost as a huge open air prison, and where doctors are sounding the alarm and saying we're running out of medicines, where the rate of unemployment is up around 65%. I think that these are awarenesses that are much more broadly shared, and that's because of the summer activity of the flotilla.
Recently on the Electronic Intifada, in fact, I think it was just a few days ago, there was an article written by an Israeli-American freelance journalist, and she opined that actions like the flotilla and the involvement of international activists in the Welcome to Palestine campaign often unintentionally drown out real Palestinian voices by focusing, you know, on the situation and the chaos that's created when Israel attempts to block these activists. Do you agree or disagree with this view? Do you sometimes think that unintentionally you may actually silence the very voices that you're trying to give a channel for expression?
Well, we should always be open to that criticism and really examine how we are presenting our message. And it's difficult. Sometimes I think you can't hook people's interest unless there's some kind of a story that awakens people and makes them at least wonder, now how come, why are all these people sitting in a harbor and they're not being let go, and why are they being confined? And you have to at least tell that story in order to make the hook. But I think that the reality is that many people in the United States have much more access to influencing, and it won't be a huge influence, but some influence will be accomplished, much more access to influencing media than people who are in Gaza, who are getting maybe 4 to 8 hours of electricity during an average day, who don't have the capacity to amplify their voice because they are so isolated. And so but we're the ones who have the tools at our disposal much more easily than people who are bearing the brunt of the wars. And so it's a criticism that should be listened to carefully. I sometimes say to myself, you know, if you wait till you're perfect, you're going to wait a very long time. but really, we have to be open to that criticism and then go back to the drawing board and look at what we've written and see if it's self-serving rather than amplifying the voices of people whose voices we're trying to bring attention to in the first place. But, you know, on the other hand, having some kind of a story that awakens people is part of the political process in the United States.
That's so very true. I remember sitting with the founder of this radio program, Sharif Fahm, many, many years ago, and I remember her turning to me and saying, well, do you think that Palestine will ever be free? And, you know, there was such pain and anguish in his voice. And if you had known Sharif, he was very dedicated, committed. There was no one more passionate than him about Palestine. And, you know, he also said to me, does anything we do, does this radio show, does it make a difference? And in light of those type of questions, how can people who care about Palestine and care about what's happening in their world keep their spirits up in the face of such oppression and injustice? And I know you have a long history of working against war and oppression. What insights do you have to give to our listeners today?
Well, there's a woman named Muriel Lester, whom I've admired a great deal. She was a British activist, and she put it quite bluntly. She said, which side do you want to be on? Would you rather be on the side of the fat cats? That was her phrase, who are profiting working from wars and promoting wars all over the planet. So one of the things that I think helps keep spirits up is just a humble, grateful recognition that in doing the kind of work that we're doing, and maybe, you know, all of us are only planting seeds and it's another generation in the future that we hope would, you know, reap a harvest, but you get the opportunity to rub shoulders with some of the finest people in the world. I mean, I certainly felt that even when I was in Gaza and it was under bombardment, I was living with a courageous family and, you know, young university students were guiding me to walk through the areas that had been bombed after the bombing ended. And I thought, these are some of the finest people in the world, given the trauma they've been through, that they're able to be as resilient as they are and, in fact, to overcome bitterness as well as they did. So I think humble gratitude and finding kindred spirits amongst people that you're really fortunate to be with is one thing that helps kind of put wind back in one's sails and keep going. And then, of course, there's just the very utilitarian calculus that I mentioned before. You know, we have at our fingertips, many of us, several computers in our homes and these whiz-bang BlackBerry phone deals that you can take on the road with you, and increasing capacities for social media. And so if we're sort of sitting on top of all kinds of resources, why ever in the world, given the comforts that we have comparatively, I mean, when I'm in a place with no electricity, you know, you do your best to adjust, but I'll tell you, it takes me 8 seconds to get adjusted to electricity when I come back home. You know, the lights are on and the computers are whirring, and I grow very, very accustomed to the pampered and luxurious life relative to where I've often been if I've gone to particularly to a war zone and to places where there's intense impoverishment. So given that we have all these resources, and it's purely by accident of where we were born, it's not like we did something to earn it that others wouldn't have been able to accomplish had they had the good fortune to be born into an area where we're so protected from abject suffering. So use those resources. And so the other thing I learned in Iraq, sitting at the bedsides of children who would never go home and whose mothers were trying to adjust to the reality that they would eventually carry this beloved child to a cemetery. And they had more children that they hoped might survive. And I realized, these women can't afford my despair. And I think that's true of many people who are trapped in the war zones, whether it's in Afghanistan or in North Waziristan or in Gaza, where United States weapons are pounding away, or weapons that we've given to other governments like Israel are pounding away. The people there can't afford our despair. We're the ones who are, you know, directly responsible.
And that's so very true. And unfortunately, we've run out of time. But I thank you so much, Kathy, for joining us today and sharing your voice with us. And we wish
thank you. Thank you, Justina. I wonder if before saying goodbye, could I just mention the phone number that your listeners could call?
Sure.
The State Department Operations Center is open today. And it's 202-547-4000. And that's the number that could be called to appeal to the State Department to free the boat that's still docked in a military harbor.
And thank you so much for reminding us of that. Best of luck in your future endeavors. Take care.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
This concludes another edition of This Week in Palestine, a 45-minute segment that is part of Truth and Justice Radio, airing on WZBC 90.3 FM from 6 to 10 a.m. We hope you join us again next week for news and views from Palestine. Thank you.
طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم إلى بلد مهجرين